Hey, welcome to Old School Guns. This is the podcast that has the news, opinion, and answers that you want to know. And remember, we're supported by no one, we're beholden to no one, and we're not as smooth or as polished as a lot of the other things that are out there, either on the internet or as podcasts. So what you're getting is straight, honest talk, and it's a conversation between us. So let's get right into it. There's some news that's it's obliquely affects gun owners. There's this Kim Kardashian, who's this, you know, kind of pop culture person. I don't really know that much about her. I don't really follow her, but I did see a little news headline where she's like a lot of famous people. They introduce makeup lines and clothing lines and things, and she had a lingerie line that was called Kimono. And apparently the Japanese took huge offense to this, huge offense. So even to the point where, even though she's now agreed to rename the line something else, that the Japanese trade minister is going to send a delegation over to the United States to talk over the situation and monitor the situation. I mean, this is just so silly that it's almost a Monty Python skit. I mean, she said she's going to rename it. First of all, calling her clothing line Kimono is no insult to anyone. It kind of goes to this phony idea of cultural appropriation. I suppose if I make a knife and call it a Tanto, well, that's a Japanese form of knife, so maybe that's cultural appropriation. I don't make knives, but does that mean that no other company outside of Japan can make a Tanto? I mean, it's just ridiculous. And, you know, but this is what our politicians and our media and our culture focuses on, this garbage. I mean, it's just a wasteland. You know, it's just absolutely ridiculous with the problems that are facing people in real life and in the real world. This is just ridiculousness. Speaking of ridiculous, Governor Northam, the despicable guy who went by the horrible nickname Coon Man and has become governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, has even admitted that no gun control law could have prevented the Virginia Beach shootings. So then why are you trying to pass more gun control laws? And I think the answer really is, the end game now is they've always wanted total confiscation, total prohibition on firearms. I used to think that was kind of a conspiracy theory, but there's no satiating these people. They, no matter what laws you put into effect, they simply will not ever be satisfied. So I think what they want to basically say is, you know, gun control laws don't work. Therefore, the only thing that will work is a total confiscation, total ban. And, you know, you see in places like New Zealand where they're trying something similar to that is kind of a model for these, you know, far left wackos who even know what they're doing is false. They even know it's BS. And yet they're continuing to push it anyway. And as an aside, his lieutenant governor, Mr. Fairfax, just had to resign from his law firm due to the allegations against him. And this guy is, you know, if these things are to be believed, which I think there's very strong evidence that there is, he's a serial sexual assaulter. And I mean, does he and Northam even have the character to morally govern, to lead, to be a person that can make trusted with any kind of decision? I would say no. They need to be compelled to leave office, whether they resign or are impeached or whatever the mechanism is that gets them out of office. And their legislature should definitely investigate and put those things into effect. Get rid of them both. They both need to be gone. And I think the next thing that I want to cover is sportsmanship. You know, when I watch some television shows, you know, you see very, very poor sportsmanship. Somebody just absolutely, you know, they can't handle that. There's going to be winners. There's going to be people who don't win. And that's just the way it is. Competition, there at the end, there can be only one. One of my favorite shows, Forged on Fire, They're such gentlemen. The people who are eliminated, basically, they almost all come out and say, "Yeah, it was my fault. I made a mistake," or whatever it is they're making, just wasn't up to snuff, and the other person did a better job. And I always thought that that's really just excellent sportsmanship, that they can just reflectively and objectively look at what they've done and say, "Yeah, I would have made the same decision if I were the judge." A lot of them even say that. So I always kind of like seeing that. I also kind of like seeing it on, the few shooting shows that used to be on. There was always a lot of, basically, "Hey, the guy just shot better. That's just the way it goes." Happens all the time. You don't have to go very far usually to find somebody who can shoot better than you. It just the way it goes. It doesn't diminish your enjoyment of it anything else, but you just have to admit there's a reality, and the scores tell the story. So, and I've even been in shooting matches where the scores were fouled up and I got a lower score than what I deserved, and I've never really protested that or anything. I've always just kind of said, "Hey, que sera, sera," because in most cases it wouldn't have made a difference anyway. It's not like, "Oh, I would have won if they did this." And there was one match I was in charge of where I actually goofed up one of the rules. And a guy called me later on and said, "Hey, you kind of did this, and I think it cost me the match." And I said, "Hey, I'll make this right for you," whatever. He said, "Nah, don't even worry about it." And the guy was a real gentleman about it. But, we're all human. We all make mistakes. And then sometimes in totaling things up, a mistake can be made, and just don't worry about it. But you come to the world of professional sports, and oh my God, and I think I consider this soccer business essentially professional sports. These gals have all politicized this female soccer team. It's a lot of politics as to whether or not they would go to the White House. This is even before they won. I mean, it's still ongoing. But the thing yesterday of the, they defeat England, and the one girl decides she's going to mimic, kind of troll them by mimicking tea drinking or something else. That is low class. That is really low class. I really would have expected better. And they're poor. You do stuff like that, you're a poor representative of your country. You should tell people the truth. "Hey, it was a tough match. Today was our day. We won." On the few times where I've ever won a shooting match or placed high in it, when somebody says, "Hey, congratulations, you really did great," I said, "There was a lot of luck involved." And, there is a lot of luck involved in both professional sports and even competing on a club or a very informal level. Sometimes it's your day. Sometimes you see better. You're absolutely in the zone and you're shooting better. Other days, probably not so much. And being a gentleman and being a courteous winner, a gracious winner, is really something that our society is really kind of lost. And it's really kind of a shame, because kids look at this stuff and kids mimic what they see, and especially what they see some of these professional athlete jackasses do. And that is, that is not a good life lesson, and that is definitely not a good example. So I can only say that I'm extremely disappointed in this kind of stuff. When somebody says they're not going to go to the effing White House based on bringing their sexual orientation into something that it really has no place in. These soccer players should enjoy the moment. They should enjoy being great at soccer. They should enjoy their tournament, and win or lose, they should enjoy the experience and not turn it into some political, just jackassery that's out there. It's really foolish. It's really bad. And it really needs to be something that is not present in our society. So let me get into some gun culture stuff. Kind of here we are. I've been watching some of the YouTube content creators, and I always have this, it may be snobbery, it may be credentialism, but I always find it comical when people who do not have uniformed service experience, which is either in the military or in the police. You know, the people who we pay, our society pays these people to carry firearms and use them in defense of society, whether it's in the civilian realm as the police are, or whether it's in the armed forces. There seem to be a group of kind of tactical guys who, I don't know if they come from, some of them come from tech backgrounds and a few other things. They really kind of strike me as Walter Mitty's. And especially when they're talking about, well, this is the best rifle for the military. This should have been done. That should have been done. And it's purely based on their individual handling of certain types of weapons. In a purely civilian or match setting, I mean, it's not as if they were issued these weapons, spent 3 or 4 weeks or 6 weeks in the field with them, or went through any kind of taxing training. We talked a lot about training a couple podcasts ago. And these guys are not trainers or not trained. There's that whole subject of what makes training different from education, and how training is usually not fun, and education is usually something that people like, as because it's a lot more entertaining. So there's the difference between entertainment and training. So when a guy basically says, "Hey, this is great, this is bad," I have to look at his background and say, "Well, what? Where is he coming from? What is his basis of experience?" I think with the Forgotten Weapons guy, Ian, he's kind of comes from kind of a mechanical engineering background, and you know, you don't need a military background for that. He looks at weapons and basically gives you his take, and then he also explains, you know, the mechanical intricacies and kind of why this part and that part are there, how they work together, and how the mechanism operates as a whole. You know, and that's very interesting. I find that moderately interesting. I find it more interesting with common weapons than I do some of the, you know, very rare, scarce prototype-type weapons that are out there. But, you know, that's all legit. And I'm not saying that a person has to have a military background to have an opinion. Of course, anybody can have an opinion on whatever they like. It's just how credible is that opinion. I just have to say a DD-214 is one of the few things I look for, as well as police experience. You know, it's a different kind of experience, but it's legitimate nonetheless. The thing I'll also say is you can get a wide variety of opinions of people who have DD-214s, which, by the way, I forgot to probably say, that's the discharge paper. Anybody who's been in the service knows what that is, but that's a service discharge paper, basically characterizing what you did in the service and whether with the type of discharge you received. So you'll find people who have got military experience who will tell you a wide variety of things, and you know, a lot of it is incorrect. It used to be myths that would go around that were just propagated, but you know, but people who seem to have a reasonable and cogent and logical opinions, and they have the experience to back it up, I think that's where you kind of need to look. You know, and one of the kind of illustrative points I use of that is the Colt AR-15. Because of the bad reputation it got in the early part of the Vietnam War, and it was largely undeserved bad reputation. You know, Colt was making those things. They sold some commercially, you know, the SP-1s. But they made as many as, you know, they made them for the military. They were just happy. They didn't bother to put out the truth about how good those rifles were. They just thought people would intuitively know it. But there was just horrendous articles, and you could find them in all the, not so much the mainstream gun magazines that took a lot of cold advertising and didn't really want to anger them. But you saw it a lot in the military interest magazines, you know, the Soldier of Fortune, and there used to be probably half a dozen magazines of that type of nature. And these guys were always writing anti-AR-15, anti-M16 articles, And a lot of it just wasn't true. I mean, it just factually untrue. So I would sit there and say I would also question some of that. It's really a shame that Colt never bothered to put out a public relations campaign to explain this is how good the rifle is. You know, the in-range TV mud test, which is, you know, it's a one-off and it's anecdotal and everything. Hey, Colt could have done that. They could have done that 60 years ago, 50 years ago, when the rifle was getting its severe criticism. I mean, it would not have been difficult for them to do that. And I think that the people really deserved it. I think the rifle, the design deserved it, because it really is probably the best rifle design out there. And all of the attempts to build a better mousetrap really just failed, because they can't do really anything much better, if better at all, than the AR-15 design does. So, you know, that's why it's not been replaced. And I mean, it's just the way it goes. It's been tweaked a little bit, not as much as people will think. I don't really consider the barrel twists for longer projectile, you know, stabilizing, using a 1-in-7 twist because you have to stabilize a tracer is a military consideration, but not really a civilian consideration. So, you know, the 1-in-12 twist, for what that rifle was designed for, works exceptionally well, and they sell 1-in-12 twist rifles today. I mean, the Brownells Retro line has got them, and you can buy them from barrel manufacturers. And most of the other manufacturers sell like a 1-in-9 or 1-in-8. Few sell 1-in-7, but you know, unless you're going to stabilize very heavy projectiles for a specific use, the 55 grain stuff is the standard. I mean, it's never been knocked off its perch. So, you know, that's one example of, you could get bad information about a very, very good, very, very good weapon. And for years, when I bought my first AR-15, it was an SP-1. And I paid a whopping $241 for it new. And I had it out at the range. And literally, people would walk by and just say, that's a piece of shit. You know, they were just the nastiest stuff, because they had been fed all this. They didn't know. They'd never touched one. And in point of fact, mine was probably the first one they'd ever seen. They weren't that. It isn't like nowadays where ARs are all over ranges. This was a very rare sighting to see an AR at a range. And to the older guy, you couldn't even get M1s in those days either. There were no M1s. There was a very nascent industry, you know, producing M1As, and they were kind of going in and out. It wasn't the commercial Springfield Armory of today, which is had it in production for decades. It was kind of a couple of smaller manufacturers were making them, and they were pretty good, but you never saw them. I mean, you just didn't see them very often. And if you did, you know, getting magazines for them was difficult. It's not like you could just, you know, you had to get something like Shotgun News and hope that one of the surplus guys had magazines. Same thing with AR magazines. You just didn't see them. That stuff had not yet proliferated like crazy. Couldn't get M1s. They couldn't import them, and they would only release like 300 rifles a year to match shooters. You know, your chance of getting one of those. There were guys who were on the list to get one for 8-9 years. So, you know, you just didn't have them. And they had sold out. The DCM had sold out of their M1 carbines, and the GCA of 68 meant that they couldn't sell any more effectively. So, you know, there weren't a lot of things out there. People were shooting Springfields, and there wasn't a big military rifle market. Most military rifles were seen as junk. You see that right around the time of the Kennedy assassination, where they said, you know, how could a rifle as crummy as a Carcano, you know, possibly be used to kill someone? And it's because it had a very bad reputation. Even the Mausers did not have a great reputation. They were really prized because they were used to make custom rifles. But yeah, there was a lot of bad information about the AR-15. I remember even after the Mini 14 was introduced, I was actually in the service, and I was talking to a guy who was an Army major, and he was a big Mini 14 guy, and he said, this is the one the Army should have adopted and all that. Of course, in hindsight, we see that would not have been the optimal choice. That would not have been a very good choice. But people believed it, and they believed it because the AR-15 had such a, quote, terrible reputation. And part of what contributed to that on the civilian side was you couldn't really get decent ammo. And I mentioned this in another podcast, but if you hand-loaded, the only FMJs you could get were designed to were varmint bullets designed to not explode and preserve the pelts. And they had kind of this blunt tip, so they would hang up on the feed ramps. You know, it was a cartridge that the rifle was not designed to a bullet style the rifle was not designed to handle. And then you had soft points, and soft points could deform and hang up on the feed ramps also. So you know there was no really good ammunition for the early ARs. It was all hunting ammunition, and it was all designed for to be shot out of essentially bolt-action rifles and perform its intended purpose on game or varmints. So that's what you had. So, you know, that didn't help at all. It would have helped if Colt had kind of marketed some, you know, Ball 193 type ammo. That probably would have helped the reputation quite a bit. But, you know, that'll show you that a person's experience may or may not actually give you the truth. But, you know, when I hear a lot of this, I hear a lot of these opinions about military and infantry rifles from people with no experience in it, I do question that a little bit. You know, 3-gun matches, 2-gun matches, service rifle matches, any kind of a match is just not the same as either simulated combat on maneuvers or training, squad level live fire training, or even the individual kind of training and combatives that you get in the military. So it's a whole different set of skills, a whole different scene, that as opposed to competitively firing even in a tactical style match. And this brings me to another subject, which is near and dear to my heart, and that is throwing shade on the M1 carbine. You know, the M1 carbine is a great little rifle in many ways. It is certainly not perfect. And, you know, most of the military examples of the M1 carbine are 70 years old and older. So you're talking about a gun that's just not current. They do make some modern versions of it. The quality of those I can't really speak to. I've not really used them. They look okay. They're pretty pricey. I think they run... into the neighborhood of $1,000 and probably that $900 to $1,200 price window. So they're pricey. But, you know, you can't expect it to be an AR. You just can't. It was designed for an entirely different purpose, and that is just replacing a handgun in the hands of troops that may need to defend themselves or may need a lightweight weapon, because they're doing something else at the time. They're crewing a mortar, they're crewing a howitzer, they're driving trucks, they're doing something else rather than engaging the enemy with a service rifle like the infantry does. So it was meant for somebody else, and it was meant to be an improvement over the pistol, because, you know, militarily they found out stocked pistols didn't work out very well. You know, they were, by the time you get the stock on the thing and everything else, get it ready for action, it's really not a weapon you can use just off the spur of the moment. Just pick up and start firing. I mean, you got to attach the stock to the back end of the pistol and all that. So a lightweight rifle made a lot of sense. It was in a reasonable caliber. We could make 30 caliber barrels very easily, so we chose a 30 caliber straight-walled cartridge. I think they would have been a little better off going with a 35, but, you know, that's just me. That's just my opinion, because I think in the end it wouldn't have mattered anyway. But anyway, they came out 30 carbine. The only real criticisms I've ever heard of the 30 carbine amongst people who actually used it in combat and in, you know, serious situations, is that the cartridge was light, but everybody knows that going into it. Everybody knows that it's not a Garand. And of course, when you're shooting at somebody, your weapon feels rather insubstantial and underpowered anyway. At least that's the experience I've gotten. So, you know, it was a good weapon for its intended purpose. It was excellent. And the only real criticisms I've ever heard of it were from Korean War. And I've read some of these and all that, where it's, you know, the stopping power just kind of was lacking. And when you're comparing it to a Garand or an M3 grease gun or a Thompson, even at close range, yeah, you can see there might have been the observed effects of stopping power may have been different. It was still a good lethal cartridge, and it was still a good lightweight rifle, but it was never meant to be a substitute for a battle rifle. So, and it was never meant to be an assault rifle. It was meant to be an ancillary arm for troops who had a much lower probability of coming into contact, but that probability still existed, and they would need a weapon more effective than a pistol and something lighter than a submachine gun and definitely smaller and more portable than a battle rifle. So there you are. That's what the M1 carbine was for. If it doesn't do well in 2 and 3 gun matches, you know, I don't know what to say about that. It depends on the kind of carbine, the shape it's in. Is it a commercial one? Is it a military one? Has it been inspected? You know, make sure that the sight is staked on it. Make sure that the springs are in good shape. And all those things that you should do to ensure a rifle is ready to go. And the other thing is you might, you know, tapering the expectation that it's not a brand new AR. It's a 70-year-old substitute ancillary weapon is probably the best thing. But I don't think it deserves shade thrown on it. I think the carbine it's saved a lot more lives than we can probably count. Having that instead of a pistol is a much, much better option. And it saved probably thousands, if not tens of thousands of lives. So it's a great weapon, and we should see it for what it is and not really compare it to the new stuff that we have today. Okay, here comes my favorite part of the show, which is questions and answers. First question we have is, was the Colt Model 1909 revolver used in World War I? Well, as far as I know, and my research, you know, just reading a few books and things goes, it was not used in the combat zone. I mean, now again, somebody could have had one and carried it, or, you know, you never know what. On an individual basis, I would never say that absolutely not a single one got over there. I would say that it was a pure anomaly, and it was a deliberate act for somebody to bring a revolver they liked, simply because it was by that time, 45 Colt was a non-standard caliber. It was an obsolete caliber, and they didn't use it. It's a great revolver, great round, and it became the basis for the Model 1917, which was used in 45 ACP, and later, after the war, they developed the auto rim cartridge, one of my favorite revolver cartridges in the world for it. So it was definitely, it's the Colt new service in 45 Colt. Commercially, I think several police agencies and the RCMP and a few things have used it. Militarily, I think a few were sold to Great Britain, you know, and especially in the early part of the war, where, you know, the Allies were just gathering any weapon they could, and they just came over to the United States and were buying weapons like crazy. I think basically until they ran out of money. So until they could get their credit arrangements set up. So, but I think in 45 Colt, it had pretty much seen its day. I'm sure it got a lot of use stateside for guards and probably some sort of police forces or police type deal, federal police, you know. I'm sure there's a long list of government agencies that kind of used it. It was a very good revolver, very powerful, and I mean, it's a nice gun, and the fit and finish pre-war commercial standard. So it's the interior is very smooth. And in those days, you know, they kind of hand finished the interior on their commercial guns. So the interior parts were kind of hand finished and fitted. The outside had a very, very beautiful bluing. Very, very nice gun. And you know, there was some sabotage in World War One. There was a German-American population that was really didn't like the Allies, and you know, there were some things that went on. There were some bombings and a few other things that happened, and so, you know, security, homeland security, to use a century later term, was taken pretty seriously. So I'm sure they were scooped up and used in that effort. Okay, another question, and this is on military rifles. What is the worst pre-World War II military rifle? I'll just kind of have that go through the war, I suppose. So by pre-1945, which is the worst military rifle? The answer is I don't really know, but I can tell you what some of my least favorites are. And I would have to say the top of the list would have to be these Austrian 95 Mannlicher 8x56 or something straight pull rifles. My very limited experience with them is that they have kind of wicked recoil. The sights don't, and this may be an ammunition problem, modern ammunition problem. The sights don't seem to be very well regulated on those. And interesting guns. They've got a lot of different markings and a unique design, but definitely not anything I would ever want to be issued. I would take a Carcano carbine over one of those. I just would. I think at a certain point, you have to look at some of these short rifles and carbines and say, hey, is the increased recoil really worth having a smaller, more convenient package? I think a couple others on that list would be the 6.5 Arisaka. I really don't dig that gun at all. It's kind of long, bulky. It just doesn't seem to really be very powerful for what you get. Even the Japanese basically kind of threw their hands up with it and went to 7.7 caliber. So I would say that the 6.5 Arisaka would be on my list. Let's see, you know, and this will PO a lot of people, but, you know, I've never cared for the 98K and its variants, the short rifle and 8mm Mauser. You know, I don't like the recoil. The handling is nice. The gun is very reliable. And even the later war production ones, which don't have the fit and finish and have, you know, machine marks all over them, I would even say that those are excellent, technically excellent guns, and they still work perfectly fine. But just don't care for the 8mm cartridge. I think it just generates too much recoil for what you really get. It just seems to me, and this is purely subjective, and you know, you can probably find some science that does not support what I'm going to say. It always feels like it has more felt recoil to me than what a similar gun in 30-06. Maybe that's just because I'm more used to shooting 30-06, and my expectations are a little are already pretty much formed. But I never cared for the 8mm Mauser, even in the longer rifles like the Gewehr 98, the original one with the long barrel and the roller coaster sight, and some of the 9820, the Czech 9822, another great rifle. I can deal with it in that, but I really don't enjoy it that much. So I would have to say that 8mm Mauser 98K is probably my least favorite. So those are the ones I really don't care for. I'm sure there's some obtuse ones, and I'm kind of leaving off the little tiny ones. I don't think that there are a lot of other rifles there, and a lot of the earlier rifles I leave them off too. You know, clearly the Lebel, the 1886 Lebel, and the Berthier Model 1916. I mean, they're clunky. They're kind of fun to shoot. They're fun to shoot because I do enjoy the 8mm Lebel does not have a lot of recoil, and it's kind of a fun cartridge. Very cool cartridge too. Kind of has that funny taper to it and big rim on it. But yeah, those are kind of clunky. But I consider them really World War One earlier designs. And yeah, I don't really care for any of those either, but I think my least favorite of any pre-1945 is probably that M95 Mannlicher. Okay, here is the question that follows that. What is the worst military rifle after World War II? That takes a little bit of thinking because there's a few. I do have to say that when it comes to clunky, looking like something from Planet of the Apes, the VZ-52 and 52-57. As much as I like Czech weapons, and I do really like Czech weapons, I thought the VZ-58 is absolutely outstanding. But the 52 and the 52-57 are clunky Planet. They should be props on Planet of the Apes. That's all I can really say about them. The magazine loading offers no advantage. Awkward. The stocks are just chunky, and the sights on them are rudimentary. It's just there's very little to like there. And the early ones are in the oddball 7.62 by 45 caliber, which is very difficult to find today. And the later, even the later ones in 7.62 by 39 are they're no prizes. So I would say that that's got to be one of the worst. Post-World War II rifles. I don't really care for the SKS. I don't know if it's a worst or bad rifle. To me, it just kind of leaves me kind of going, "Eh, it's okay. It's nothing really exciting about it. It's reasonably accurate. It's very reliable. It doesn't really have any compelling looks. It other than its historical associations, you see it in photographs of some battles and some honor guards, I think, still use them today. But I don't really care for the SKS. I really don't like the stripper clip loading. I think fumbling around with that under any kind of pressure or tension is going to be a real pain. So yeah, that's a and the Soviets saw it. They dumped it. They still made them and handed them out to people who needed kind of a it was good military aid. They cranked them out. The whole Warsaw Pact, it seems like, cranked out one version after another, making it a really interesting collectible because there's a lot of different versions out there. But as far as a rifle that I would want to be issued now, I don't really care for the SKS. I think that was just a goner. Other post-war rifles, fundamentally, there. If we separate the intermediate cartridge rifles from the last of the battle rifles, which rolled off into the 60s, definitely the intermediate cartridge rifles are all pretty much the same. The best of the breed is the AR-15 M16, and it's the best by a long shot. The AK-47 proliferated, and of course it morphed into the 74. Great guns in many ways. I still don't like the non-bolt hold open device. That to me is a deal breaker. But they're a lot of fun to shoot and great rifles. But really the AR is the king, and everything else I don't really dislike, but I don't really fall in love with. The battle rifles, to me, the big three are still the best, and I enjoy all three of them. I don't like the lack of a bolt hold open on the G3, but it's with the claw mount and a German army telescope on it. It's a lot of fun to shoot. You can see where, it was a great assault rifle for what they were doing at the time. And given their experience, the German experience on the Eastern Front, you can really see why they came up with the G3. I think the most elegant design is the FNFAL. I love it. It's beautiful. It suits me in many, many ways. But I think I shoot the M14 style probably the best. And I think in many ways it's the best thought out for large scale issue and use. So those are all about, that's basically how I see those rifles. Okay, related question came up. Best World War II handgun. Kind of talked about this last podcast. I think hands down, it's 1911 A1, followed by the P-38. Browning High Power certainly probably tied with the P-38. Yeah, excellent, excellent. Everything else is just kind of everything else. You know, the Luger was pretty creaky and kind of at the end of its life by then. Still very well made and actually a lot more reliable than people give it credit for. You know, Tokarev was there, basically a Browning design. The Radom, of course, Polish, then German occupation production Radom. Excellent gun. But, you know, the 1911 A1 just withstood the test of time. And, you know, the design is still out there today being used for a whole variety of things. So I'd say that's it. The worst handgun of World War II is the next question. That's going to take a little bit of thinking. Well, getting rid of the Liberator, because you could always say the Liberator is the worst. It's the cheapest, single shot, doesn't even have an extractor. But getting rid of that, that was never designed to be issued to troops. The worst one has to be, there was a Japanese Type 26. I think that was a revolver, Type 94. They made some cheap one, kind of discounting that. I think the Nambu is probably the worst. A quirky design, took quirky ammo. You know, for what you need a military handgun for, probably is the, it probably is barely sufficient, you know. I mean, the Japanese used it just for ancillary things. They didn't really didn't do a whole lot with it. So that's it. I suppose you could say the Nagant revolver was one of the worst, although I think it's a lot very reliable gun, but it has nothing else that I'm interested in. It's a, it was pretty archaic design, just used because it was available. So, you know, there you go. It was used because it was available and it really wasn't that good, but really military handguns, the use of them and the importance of them is a lot of times overstated. It's certainly not the equal of your service rifle or anything similar to that. So, you know, does it really matter how good or bad it is? Well, it matters some, but not as much as most people would think. And here's another related question. Best military revolver of World War II? Well, I'm going to eliminate the Webley right then and there. I mean, the horrible double-action trigger pull, very heavy trigger pull on all the Webleys kind of takes it out. And the 38-200 cartridge matched with the Webley's trigger pull for the small frame, you know, Webleys. Yeah, there's nothing there that I really like. Nothing there that I think is really worthwhile. Nagant revolver, we talked about that. That's horrible. I would say that the best revolver of World War II was also the best revolver of World War I, which was the 1917. I prefer the Smith & Wesson over the Colt, but other people might prefer the Colt. But the Smith & Wesson Model 1917, a great revolver. You know, powerful, reliable, very, very efficient design. It's a large revolver, but there's not a lot of excess bulk on it or anything. They had that design and it adapted very, very well to the 45 cartridge. So 45 ACP was great in it with the moon clips, the half moon clips. You could just toss them right in there. Loaded quickly, ejected quickly. Nice, very, very nice gun. I would say the only gun that really kind of comes close to it is the Victory model in 38 Special, the one the U.S. used. Very compact, very, very nice. 38 Special, a great round. So, you know, that was a very, very good revolver also. Colt Commando was a little bit bigger. It was the official police, a little bit bigger, and a little chunkier revolver. But it was still, it was pretty close to the Smith & Wesson, just not quite as efficient and streamlined as the Smith & Wesson is as far as additional bulk. The Smith & Wesson Victory model for the Australians and British that we made in the 38 Smith & Wesson 38-200 cartridge. Yeah, that was pretty... The revolver's nice, but that cartridge is kind of a loser. So the 38 special version is much, much better. So that's pretty much the best revolver of World War II, I would have to say. It would be the Smith & Wesson Model 1917. They basically vanished at the end of the war. A few of them were probably in private hands and may have went to Korea or even Vietnam, but... you know, by that time, most of them had gone and been surplused or used by other agencies. And you know, Smith & Wesson was smart. They kept a gun like it in the catalog for years. I think the a few foreign powers bought them. The one I'm most familiar with was the Brazilian Navy bought them. They surplused them back. I think they bought 25,000 revolvers in the late 1930s, and they surplused them back. In the late 1980s, early 1990s. And they're nice guns. They're very nice guns. And they have the Brazilian crest on them and good shooters, very, very good shooters. And they go for less than a World War I example does. So that's kind of nice too. If you can find them, they're hard to, all of them are hard to find these days because collectors and savvy shooters bought them up, and they sold dirt cheap. The Brazilian ones were selling for under $200, which even in the early 90s was dirt cheap. So they were great for the people who snagged them. They were great buys. Last question, or last part of this question, is which country made the best small automatic pistol during World War II that was issued to troops? And I'd have to say that the only two people I'm really aware of are us and the Germans. And we had the Colt 1903 pocket hammerless, which was officially used by the OSS and also given to general officers. And, you know, you can still find them with U.S. property marks on them. Very, very sleek, efficient design dating from, you know, 1903, 1904, usually in 32 or 380. A very, very nice, very compact gun. I think MacArthur had one that he used to carry in his trouser pocket. So, you know, and they're, Patton had one. They all had them. So that was pretty good. On the German side, I'm of course a fan of the PPK. I think that's one of the greatest handguns made, as not just pigeonholed into this small category, but they also had the Sauer 38H. They also had a few other designs that were out there, but it was really the Sauer and the Walther which are the best. And Walther came, they had the PP, the PPK, and variety calibers, 22 up to 380. Sauer 38H, I believe, only came in 32 ACP. So those were the about the great ones. Ah, I did forget one, though, the Italian Beretta 1934. That's up there with the other. That's up there with the PPK and the Colt. An excellent design. Was used more as just a regular service automatic than for special use. Wasn't really designed for secret agents or concealability. It was more of a general issue service pistol. But it was very small, very compact, and very, very well liked. So that's the those are the best ones, and those were the preeminent ones. And you can still find those, you know, floating around today. You know, you'll pay whatever you pay for them, but they're still examples out today, and they're still obtainable and collectible. Well, that does it for this episode of Old School Guns. I want to tell you, please push the follower button if you like what you heard, and you'll get a notification the next time an episode posts on Podbean. You can also leave us comments on our YouTube channel. You can also leave us comments or questions on our Podbean connection there. So, you know, either place, we read them, we'll look at them, and we'll bring them to you. But for right now, this is Old School Guns, out.